You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP.
I'm Dennis Wu, one of the producers of Perspectives. This edition of Perspectives is dedicated to the memory of Dr. John West. The two interviews you are about to hear came from a two-part series that Louis Sines recorded for Focus on Campus that airs on KTEP on Fridays. Here are those two segments that date back to December 2001. So you'll be hearing about the holidays, Southwestern holidays, here in the desert Southwest. We start with Louis welcoming Dr. West to the program.
Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Well, I love to do it. Like to spread my brand of knowledge or misknowledge or whatever. Folklore is my game, and I love it.
And you've been teaching folklore here for more than 30 years.
36 years. Be 37 in the spring.
As you were telling me before the program started, that before, when the semester used to go in through January, you were very involved in a lot of other faculty and students here with the holiday traditions. Tell us about some of those traditions that you were doing.
Well, one of the things that I like to remember was that we had a lot of Jewish students, and all the big to-do about Christ and Christmas was quite natural. But Hanukkah, and that time the Festival of Lights and such, was also celebrated by the students who were of Jewish persuasion. And so I made it a point. We had classes. Sometimes we could do things what we wanted to do in between terms or just as we were getting toward Christmas. And I would read Hanukkah stories and things like that in addition to a Rourke Bradford thing called How Come Christmas. I love to do it, but it's out of the black tradition, out of the Deep South. And it's kind of frowned on. I had somebody tell me afterwards, when we're trying to get away from that attitude, the plantation darky and such. And what I was enjoying and sharing, I thought, was the simple faith of the uneducated but truly devout segment of our southern population. And it was really a wonderful thing to me, but it was fine when Sandy Claus went over to see Miss Mary and see the new baby that she done had. And it was fascinating to me. And I have great respect for tradition and for the way people talk and the way they think and such. And it was fascinating to be able to share that sort of thing. But I can't do it anymore because it's just, I feel awkward because I figure somebody's going to say I'm making fun, and I certainly am not doing that any more than I would make fun of any of the traditions in my own culture. But Hanukkah was one of the things that I would share with my students, because those who are pure Christian or pure nothing would not have any background for Hanukkah. The idea of the fact that when the temple was restored in Jerusalem, there was just enough oil to last, I think, one day. I'll probably mess up the story because I don't tell it every year. But miraculously, there was enough oil that stretched to light the eternal light before the altar for 8 days. And that's the Festival of Lights. And it's a wonderful thing, but there was a more secular story that I found in a book of traditions and things that had been written about that time of year. And there was a perfectly lovely story about a little boy who was learning the traditions, and he was practicing lighting the menorah, the set of candles that are lighted in connection with the Feast of Lights. And it turns out that mother is sick in bed with diphtheria and about to die. The father had gone out in a snowstorm to bring the doctor. And, of course, it's night, and all sorts of terrible things are about to happen. But the little boy finally realizes that it's sundown and it's time to light the menorah. And if his father's not there, well, tradition must be observed. And he can't use matches because they don't allow him to do that. But he gets his little toy candle, little practice candle, and sticks it in the opening of the stove and lights it and puts it up in the window and scratches the frost off the window pane and thinks that maybe this will do to satisfy the ritual. And about that time, the father and the doctor come in time to save the mother's life. And it's a touching story. I can almost not get through it. Fortunately, when I read, I can concentrate on the reading, but it's a very moving story. And it's just as moving as many of the other traditions that have come up around Christmas time for the Christians among us. But it's fun to share these things, and it's fun to open the eyes of people who don't realize that there are other people who have traditions too. One of the things that they did just this week on KTSM on television, I didn't get to see it, but I heard about it, and they were going to do the posada, which is a very traditional thing that's done around here, particularly in the Mexican tradition. The posada replays the search for shelter, for posada, looking for an inn for the Holy Family, who are benighted. They're out in the dark and everything. And people reenact this. A couple of years ago, I had a student take me to his home for, I think it was about the 9th or 10th of December, and I was in the home that was eventually to give shelter to the Holy Family. But it goes along, as Julia Waugh tells it, the family comes along, usually with a troop of people behind it, and they have a little song that they sing, that we are in dire straits here. We're peregrinos who are disconsolate. We're seeking shelter on a foreign soil, which is a little curious because Joseph and Mary were not strangers, really. But then the people in the first place they stop and say, "We have no room. It's too late at night. There's no lodging here." They ask again, the same little thong, "We're benighted peregrinos." And finally, they say, "There's no vacancy here." And in one of the verses, the travelers are accused of being robbers. But finally, they figure out that these are unfortunate people who are benighted, as the old saying is. The people in the seeking shelter saying, "Open your doors to us, to poor unfortunates. We are tired with travel. We need to rest." Then they say, "Who knocks this unseemly hour in a cold night asking shelter?" And they finally say, "Poor travelers address you, Mary and Joseph," and Mary is far gone in her stages of pregnancy. So they open the door and let them in. And, of course, this is by prearrangement. Traditionally, they go to seven houses, and they're turned away six times. And then in the seventh house, they are allowed to come in, and a feast has been prepared, and all the neighbors come in and enjoy and everything, and they sing songs not just to Mary and Joseph, but to the Christ child, which is somewhat anachronistic because he hasn't been born yet. But that's all right. It's a wonderful thing. One of the verses that they sing is, "Jesus, Joseph, and Mary, I offer you my dwelling place, my heart and my soul," which is very touching. And that comes from a very lovely little book that I wish I had dozens of copies of so I could sell them or give them to my friends. It's called The Silver Cradle. A lady who lived down in San Antonio hace muchos años. This concentrates on the various traditions that are celebrated in the barrio in San Antonio. San Antonio is thought of in that area as a little Mexico. There are so many refugees, where they were from the time of the Mexican Revolution and so on. But Julia Knott Waugh, W-A-U-G-H, wrote this, The Silver Cradle, and it has been republished in recent years with an introduction by Felix Almaraz, who works at the University of San Antonio, quite an interesting fellow, historian and such. But the Silver Cradle is one of the treasures of this barrio that Mrs. Waugh concentrates on. One family seems to be the heart of the tradition keeping. And the lady who looks after the Silver Cradle is the very heart of things. And they set up the manger scene and all that, and they go at it probably 2 weeks at a time, putting things together and such. Finally, they bring out the cradle, but it is empty. And a stranger or a Protestant who comes along thinks, well, hey, where's the baby Jesus? He has a place in this. Are you forgetting him? He's the chief actor. And they say, wait just a minute. He doesn't come till Christmas Eve night. And you don't rush him. And people who put out the manger scene on the 9th of December or whenever with the baby Jesus in the cradle, they're just not thinking. And sometimes we do this sort of thing in churches and such. We did the acting out at University Presbyterian Church one time. This is an Anglo church, and it was Protestant and all that. But we had a real live baby who is now a freshman at New Mexico State. And the minister was interested in what a wonderful and what a realistic presentation we did. And who was the boy? Who was he? Well, the boy was a girl. And it just blew him away. Because, you know, you take what you got, and this is a darling little girl. She's a darling young woman. And we carried out the tradition, regardless of the absence of accuracy in sex. But The Silver Cradle is a fascinating book. I don't know. I'm sure they have copies of it at all of the branches of the El Paso Public Library. But it's a book that every family that wants to know about the Hispanic tradition and the traditions that people carry on in the Mexican-American part of the Spanish Southwest, they ought to have a copy of this, because it would do them some good to read portions of it as the year goes on. It's not exactly something for every month of the year, but it's in that neighborhood. And, of course, there are specifics in this book, like the fact that the baby Jesus is not put in the cradle until the proper night. In the Mexican tradition, kids don't get their Christmas presents on Christmas. They get them on the 6th of January, Epiphany, because that's the day that the Magi, the three kings, the Tres Reyes, show up with their gifts for the baby Jesus. So in imitation or something, they do the same thing for the children. And you have a new celebration that you want to work in, you can move in on one that's existing and change it poco a poco. And that's essentially what happened. In fact, there's the possibility that the birth of Christ was not in cold January or December, but in middle of the summer. But it's a little hard to tell. But if you go by the lunar calendar and that sort of thing, you could probably prove that we are about 6 months off, but that's all right. We need a time to celebrate. And since the winter solstice was already being celebrated, why not just move in with this next promise, the promise of obvious God's love for us? And, of course, Christ was a representation of that. It's a lot of fun to talk about these things. Probably I run out of time somewhere along the line.
Those of you who tuned in, we heard the first part of our interview talking about folklore and holiday traditions along the Southwest and the border. One of the things that we were talking about, you talked a little bit about the posadas, you talked about Hanukkah, you talked about some of the other traditions. And today we want to focus a little bit about some of those traditions also, but as we approach the new year, some of the traditions that we have here for New Year celebration, for the Day of Epiphany, and also some of those holiday foods that a lot of us have taken advantage of eating but wondered, what are the origins of this, or how did this get started?
Well, there are lots of arguments about how this and that and the other got started. The basic timing for Christmas, of course, goes back to the winter solstice, when the sun has been getting smaller and smaller and the daylight has been getting less and less. Then finally, around the 24th or thereabouts of December, it starts stretching, and there is the promise that the sun will not desert us. And sun worshipers and people who are looking forward to the warmth that the sun provides for growing their plants and their crops, they are naturally very positive about concern for the sun and that sort of thing. And when you have an existing tradition, an existing celebration, then you can always work a new one in. The Christian tradition, which the birth of Jesus is supposed to have taken place in the summertime, not in cold December, but that's beside the point. You have a good time for focusing people's attention. It's easier to focus on something that's already existing, and you just move the old over a little bit and make room for the new. But there are a lot of other things that take place at the same time of year. Hanukkah, the festival of lights that's part of the Jewish tradition, is at the same general time of year. And these days we have the black celebration, Kwanzaa. Everybody has traditions and things that they remember. For example, practically every Mexican-American family remembers when Mama and Abuelita used to get together in the kitchen and make tamales. And it was a special thing. Of course, tamales are still special, but you can go to one of the grocery stores, whatever name it masquerades under these days, and you can celebrate with the festival food. But in the old days, it was more the production of tamales was more a part of the tradition than anything else. And one of the curiosities, I think I've mentioned this before in years past, there is a tradition that nobody enters or leaves the kitchen during the construction of all the tamales. And the idea is that something will happen, the tamales won't cook or something like that. But the bottom line is you got a one-room kitchen and house and cold winter time, and if you open the door and a blast of cold wind comes in, you're liable to chill the masa and the tamales, and they will not develop into the tasty tidbits that they are. I ate one last night. Oh, Lord, it was good. I could eat them all day. But now Mamacita, my mother-in-law, que descansa en paz, she and my wife and various ones in the family would get together and make tamales every year. And we made a lot of sweet ones, too. Mamacita was married to a German sailor who came over here, and he was German in origin, but he had been in the American merchant marine. And he didn't think much of the canela, cinnamon, and raisins, and sugar, and that's about all that was in the sweet tamales that Mamacita would make early. But he liked more sweetness, more substance to his sweet tamales. So she added this and added that, and before long, her sweet tamales got to be as rich as fruitcake. And when Miss Lucy, my wife, makes them, I can't eat more than one. They are so rich. Oh, and I'm glad that my father-in-law objected to the blandness of the cinnamon and raisin variety. But there are all sorts of other traditions. When I was a kid, we came here from Mississippi because this was a place for people with lung problems to recuperate. I had a sister who had pneumonia three times, I think, before she was a year old. And so the doctors sent her west to this place. Well, there are a lot of places over in the east side in the neighborhood of North Cotton where there are upstairs porches with screens where people who came out here with lung problems slept almost in the open air. Well, we had things that we missed. I didn't miss because I was born here, but the rest of the family missed because there were things that they did in Mississippi. It was bird hunting season and that sort of thing. So every year, my uncles would send lard buckets, gallon lard buckets, full of partridges that had been shot and had been plucked and everything and cooked. And they were sent to us in a molasses bucket of lard. Cholesterol, forget it. But we got these partridges, and this was something that we looked forward every year. my father's mother, Grandmother West, always sent us a crate, a whole crate of oranges and huge bags of nuts and things like that, because we were sort of the poor branch of the family, and she figured that we wouldn't have many Christmas dainties and such unless she helped provide it. Of course, there are some pretty wild tales about Grandmother and my daddy and his brother. They gave her a football one time for Christmas. They figured that if she couldn't use it, they could. It wouldn't go to waste. And they bought her a case of shotgun shells one time when they were old enough to hunt and things like that. But there are a lot of wild things that are associated with this particular time of year. And, of course, one of the good things about it is that we have time off from school and frequently time off from work so that we can explore the resting parts of our souls. And it's a lot of fun to have these things. The tradition of kicking back, and, of course, we have just gotten through eating turkey and pumpkin pie and such at Thanksgiving. But 2-3 weeks later, here comes Christmas, and, oh, we got to put the big pot in the little one. There are people who have baked hams and such to go along with turkey and just all sorts of things. And if you got a smaller family, well, you may have a baked hen instead of a baked turkey. But the idea is you got to celebrate. It's something special. And, of course, we have the special Thanksgiving in this part of the country when and where the first Thanksgiving took place down here close to San Elisario, when Don Juan de Oñate and his family, I think it was that bunch that came up this way, and they came across the desert of Samalayuca, and they were just gasping for breath and starving for water and such, and they finally made it to the river, and the Indians came and helped them like the ones in Plymouth did, the Pilgrim Fathers, and they had a celebration, and it was about 23 years before the Thanksgiving that everybody celebrates who doesn't know any better. But if it's a time to celebrate, why, by golly, celebrate.
Now, as we approach the end of the year and getting ready for the new year, do celebrations for New Year vary from culture to culture?
Oh, yes, they frequently do. In the South, particularly back in the time when people loaded their own guns, you know, with powder and shot and that sort of thing, they had gunpowder around, and they had what was called an anvil shoot. They'd take two of these anvils that blacksmiths pound horseshoes into the right shape on and that sort of thing. The bottom is hollow. There's place for about, oh, maybe 3 cups of powder or whatever you want to put in there. So you put one face down, and then you put a bunch of powder in there, and then you put another one on top, and then you light the powder, and that top anvil goes sailing through the air, and you get a big bang. In Mississippi, my mother grew up in that tradition, and they shot fireworks at Christmas. They didn't think about it at 4th of July. In fact, some places until, the 1970s, they didn't celebrate the 4th of July. For example, in Vicksburg, which fell to the Yankees on 4th of July in 1863, they didn't even pay any attention to 4th of July until that recently, in the 1970s. But there are changes. The ideas of going around from house to house, sort of like the posadas, but people would go all dressed up in masquerade, and they'd go from house to house almost threatening. It was a forerunner maybe of trick or treat. We'll do you mischief if you don't invite us in. And, of course, the knowledgeable families would have cake and wine and whatever set out for the revelers. But this comes over from England. There was a whole lot of that kind of celebration and such. And we have it from time to time when a couple gets married, especially when the old man is old and the young girl is young. They really give them a hard time. They do all sorts of things to embarrass them, particularly the young girl. And they have to provide a feast for the people who come around to raise sand with them. But there are all sorts of things, hunting festivals and hunting traditions, like when a boy in Mississippi kills his first deer, they mark him with the deer's blood on the face and such, and they cut his shirt tail off. Similarly, I think when a person solos in his first solo airplane flight, they cut his shirt tail off, or her shirt tail off, presuming she has a shirt tail. But things like this move from culture to culture, group to group, and whatever seems to be the most fun and the most hilarity, that's what we do.
What about the tradition of eating black-eyed peas for New Year's?
Well, it's always tickled me. Black-eyed peas and hog jowl. Hog jowl is the cheek of a pig. And on New Year's Day, if you eat hog jowl and black-eyed peas, then you're going to have a prosperous year. And so people, even who have no connection with the farm or anything like that, will go to whatever grocery store there is handy and get a can of black-eyed peas and bring it in with maybe some pork. But the black-eyed peas seems to be the most important thing. But the bottom line is, if you are provident enough, if you have planned ahead so that in the cold wintertime you have black-eyed peas and you have some meat put up for a feast, then you're going to have a prosperous year because you are the sort that develops his or her own prosperity. It's one of those things like you're producing prosperity. You're really just giving evidence of prosperous times. You have been prosperous. You have planned ahead. But it's something that you remember to ensure the prosperity for the coming year that you want to have. And it's one of those fun things that people observe. Of course, there are people who really believe in it with all 4 feet, and they don't stop and think about the practicality of it. If you have black-eyed peas and hog jowl in January, you've been paying attention. You've been planning ahead.
Well, Dr. West, thank you very much for being with us here today. And would you care to give us again the title of the book that you read from us last week and the author?
Yes, it's The Silver Cradle by Julia Knott Waugh, W-A-U-G-H. It was published back in the 30s, I think, but it has been republished about the 70s by the University of Texas Press in Austin. And it's a fascinating little book. And if you want to learn about the culture or the Mexican-American culture, or if you want to have things to share with your children and you've forgotten about just exactly how the things go, get this book. It's a lovely little paperback, and I wouldn't take anything for my copy if I couldn't replace it.
Thank you very much for being with us, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Dr. John West and Louis Sines talking about posadas and Southwestern traditions back in December of 2001.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.